When she was 18, her father gave her the advice she needed to follow her dreams and become a writer. The next day, he had a heart attack and died in her arms. She did become a writer and a business owner and then a wife and mother. Today, after 13 books, a million of them in print, she's an award-winning syndicated columnist, a radio and TV host, and the owner of two successful companies. And now, Elise is here to help you rebuild your life. Stay tuned. This is gonna be good. This is the Elise Glink Show, rebuilding America one house at a time, starting with yours.
Everybody, welcome back to the Elise Glink Show. Here is this week's episode of the podcast. I'm Elise Glink, of course, and I'm here to help you make smart choices about your financial life. And that includes real estate, investing, inheritances, and almost anything you can think of that touches money in some way, shape, or form. Okay, let's get on with the rest of today's show. I have four amazing, fantastic, wonderful interviews set up. I think you're going to learn a lot from them. I know that I did. Our first guest is Chantel Bonneau. She's a wealth management advisor for Northwestern Mutual, and she's going to talk about their 2015 Planning and Progress study and the results of that study on millennials and money. This was really interesting, and we're going to have her back. I just have to tell you, it's an amazing interview. Our next guest is Darren Blomquist. He's the vice president for Realty Track. He's got some interesting information to share about how home payments are actually more affordable than fair market rents in more than three quarters of U.S. counties. This is great news for anybody who actually wants to buy a house. We also have Greg McBride. He's the chief financial analyst from Bankrate.com. He's got important advice for homeowners who took out home equity lines of credit before the real estate bubble burst and who are now facing higher payments after the 10-year draw period on those loans ends. So if you took out a zero interest for the first 10-year home equity line of credit, right, when it rejiggers, right? So the loan is going to convert. It's going to turn into a loan that has to be paid off in 20 years, and that is going to send your payments skyrocketing. They could even double or triple. We're going to talk about what that looks like and what the effect might be on the housing industry. Our last guest is Jeff Ball. He's CEO and president of Vizio Financial. They're a private money lender. This is also known in the world as hard money lending. So in addition to telling me why he is not like Tony Soprano, he's also telling us how real estate investors are using loans from Vizio and companies like it to increase market penetration. So if you are a real estate investor, this is a can't miss for you. All right, now that I've given you a little heads up on all of our guests, let's get started. So today I want to dig into some findings from the 2015 Northwestern Mutual Planning and Progress Study, and this examined Americans' attitudes towards their money, their finances. The report's being released in parts, and the first segment deals with millennials and their money issues. And I invited Chantel Bonneau on the show with me to talk about the findings. She's a wealth management advisor for Northwestern Mutual, and she writes for themintgrad.org, which is Northwestern Mutual's financial resource for millennials. And best of all, she happens to be a millennial herself. And unlike many of her peers, she's already a homeowner. So big stuff there. Hey, Chantel, welcome to Big Money Real Estate.
Thank you for having me.
Well, it's nice to have you here. So I love that you're a homeowner, and I love that you are a financial advisor. The financial industry is really, you know, telling me that they need about another 150,000 people like you in addition in order to manage funds for all of us as we age and as your generation ages. So it's great that you've chosen this as a profession.
Thank you. It is a very exciting career opportunity with all of the growth in our industry and so many people, both millennials, baby boomers, every generation is really understanding the value of having their finances in order. So it's a great opportunity.
Well, you hear a lot of information about millennials, but one of the things that I think people don't even realize and that your study touched on is that 64% of millennials classify themselves as being more inclined to save rather than spend, and more than half of them, about 53%, have set financial goals compared with 38% of Americans age 35 and older. Did this surprise you as a millennial when you look around your peers?
You know, it didn't really surprise me. I thought so much of the data was really interesting that came out in that Planning and Progress report. And working with millennials on a daily basis, it really didn't surprise me. So many of my peers are really focused on saving for their future, what they can do to impact their planning moving forward. And they're really focused on this being a centralized topic in their life to help them make positive decisions financially.
Now,
it was a very great study, and I'm glad that we're getting some focus on that and what good things millennials are doing.
Well, 73% of millennials expect that they will need to work past the age of 65 because Social Security isn't going to take care of their needs. And yet a third of them say that they're not at all responsible when it comes to their money, which is interesting. That's still a much higher percentage than for, you know, other areas, other populations. So when you look at this number, and you're a millennial, do you feel like people are going to need to work past 65 because Social Security won't exist? Or are you thinking that, well, 65 and you might have, you know, lived to be 100, so 35 years in retirement, you probably are going to want to need longer. What's your take on those numbers?
I think it's a combination of both of those things. So from one side, I think most millennials believe that certain entitlements that we are used to, such as Social Security, will not exist in the same form, you know, 40, 30 years from now when we would be potentially experiencing them. So there's that feeling and that sentiment that we're going to have to save more and be responsible for the future that we want and what retirement will look like for us. On the other hand, to what you spoke to, we might all live to be 100 or 105. That may be the norm down the road. So, you know, being in retirement for 40 or 45 years just might not be realistic. It takes a lot of money to be able to survive the way that you would like to in retirement. So people may be looking, as millennials start to age, to how do we have a retirement trajectory that looks a little bit different and maybe elongates more. So I think it's a combination of we may have to work because of the necessity to be able to fund those longer years, and maybe there's going to be an increased desire to work a little bit longer, a little bit more creatively, so that you can spend your retirement years differently than how we see them today.
Right. I think there's definitely a shifting. I mean, you see it. Your generation is really experiencing what I would call an elongated life, where you don't even start thinking about getting married until your late 20s or early 30s. The average age of a first-time home buyer has risen from, in the last 20 years, it was like 26 and a half, 20 years ago, 25 years ago. And today, right now, it's almost 34 years old. That is a huge shift in a 20-year period. So you're marrying later. It's taking you longer to get through college. Unfortunately, you know, longer to figure out what you want to do, longer to buy your first house. And so if you're buying your first house, having kids, that's moving later. You're now seeing that well into people's 40s. And so everything's kind of shifting out, and all of that is just going to elongate the length of time where you actually need money, to your point, to support it. Now, in terms of millennials, we saw a generation, the first half of the millennial generation, that was coming of age, and meaning by that I mean really coming out of college, right around 2008, 2009, when the economy completely derailed. And that 7 or 8 year period of millennials has had a very tough time getting started with their careers. And yet, 59% of millennials expect their financial situation to improve this year, according to the survey. That's well above what the general public is thinking. Only 41% of the general public is expecting their financial situation to improve. And 71% of millennials feel secure that they're going to achieve the financial goals they've set for themselves. What's your take on some of those numbers and the feeling that millennials may or may not be in a much better position today to take advantage of the resurging economy?
So a couple of things. To your first point, there is a new period of life that a lot of millennials have from maybe 22 to 27, 28, where they're really spending time focused on themselves. It's less about getting married earlier or starting a family as early. And part of that, I think, is leading to the sentiment that more millennials are focused on what they can do financially. They want to feel comfortable and confident financially before entering into some of those decisions. A lot of millennials think it's harder to just figure it out. They want to have some confidence in where they're progressing financially. So I think that ties into the fact that we're seeing more millennials believing that they can impact their financial future, that they can either lower some debt, maybe it's student loan debt or consumer debt that they acquired at some point, or just saving more, being more focused on retirement a little bit early. So that delayed adolescence has both pros and cons to it. But one of the pros that we're seeing is this focus on saving more and understanding how they can impact their financial trajectory now.
Yeah, I love that. The whole idea of saving money for the future is so intangible, and yet, you know, this is the time where even a very small amount of money that you put away in your 20s, even $2,000 or $3,000 a year, can translate into well over $1 million to $2 million if you get to retirement at age 75 or 80, because you really just have this incredible power of compound earnings that just goes to bat for you year in and year out. And as long as it's invested in something earning back something more than 1%, you know, over time, you're going to do it. Now, I understand you have a few tips for millennials who are hoping to buy a house someday, because this is, I know that I've heard from my kids' friends who are millennials that the idea of spending $300,000 or $400,000 on a house when their first job out of college, they maybe are earning $40,000 and they have $100,000 in college expenses. Those numbers are really real, but they aren't really conducive to home buying.
So, yes, I mean, that's one thing that I'm seeing a lot with my millennial clients is that there are so many factors happening at once. There's student loan debt. Usually it's pretty significant that they're trying to pay down. They're trying to begin saving for their future, for retirement or a wedding or something else that's going to happen. And a lot of people are still, despite the fact that the age of home ownership is going up, a lot of people are really focused on wanting to own property at some point. And I think it depends, obviously, what part of the country you live in and the cost of living for how much of a reality that may or may not be. But it is a huge focus for a lot of millennials wanting to understand at what point in their life will they be able to own property. And so whenever that topic comes up with my millennial clients, I try and bring three key points to mind to help them come to some conclusion. The first one is to get real. And what I mean by that is create a budget for yourself. What's the realistic amount you could actually spend on an ongoing mortgage? How much can you realistically save to get yourself to a down payment so that we can actually accomplish all of the things that we need to accomplish? The second one is to really look at what you can afford only. I have so many millennial clients that come in and we talk about what they potentially could afford, and they come back later and try and keep pushing the budget. And it's not my money to spend, it's theirs.
Right.
But it gets very, it's hard to start going to open houses for something way out of your budget, because then of course you want that. So really to stay within your budget and your frame. And the third thing in regard to getting real is to make sure that you don't derail the rest of your planning just to buy property. It's probably not in your best interest. Everyone's different, but it's probably not in your best interest to stop 401k contributions or eliminate all other savings, or not having proper risk management tools in place because you're putting every dollar toward a home. That can be a really risky proposition.
Well,
the second big topic mm-hmm. is to really calculate the costs of property. Too many people look only at the mortgage and they forget about homeowners insurance. What if the air conditioner breaks? What's the real cost of utilities? If you need flood insurance or earthquake insurance, how much do all of those things cost? And lastly, I always ask my clients, why are you buying or why do you want to buy? You want to make sure that you're really interested in owning and committing to property, and not just because people tell you it's a good idea or because you heard that there's a tax perk. It's really important to understand all of the components that come along with owning.
Well, I love that you got this get real, calculate your costs and why buy, because I'm very much about the reality of home ownership. And I can tell that you actually own a house, because once you've owned a house and you're faced with making, uh-oh, our second tax payments are coming up, or uh-oh, should we refinance or not, or uh-oh, wow, that hot water heater just burst and I have to spend $700 to $1,000 to get it to be replaced, until you've done that, you don't really understand how tangible and how quickly those costs add up. So I really appreciate you sharing that with us. Chantelle Bonneau is a wealth management advisor for Northwestern Mutual. And if you work with her, I can tell you're going to actually get some terrific advice. Chantelle, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
I've got my friend Darren Blomquist back on the show today. Darren is vice president at RealtyTrack, and we're going to talk about their new report on how house payments are more affordable than fair market rents in 76% of the counties. Hey, Darren, welcome back.
Thanks for having me, Elise.
Sure. So you are talking to us today from Miami, where you told me you're attending a single-family rental conference that 1,000 people are at, including a lot of big-money Wall Street. Is that right?
Yeah, absolutely. This is rental is a hot market right now, and specifically single-family rental. So these folks all, they have a conference twice a year on just specifically focused on the single family rental market. And there's 1,000 people in Miami all looking to get a piece of that market.
Wow, that's really incredible. In your new report, you actually say that 76% of counties out of 351 that house payments on a median-priced home in the first quarter of 2015 were actually lower than fair market rents on three-bedroom homes. To me, that just talks to the reason why there are 1,000 people at that conference. The deal on buying and renting these properties is still really good.
Yes, absolutely. It's cheaper to buy them, and there's a lot of renters who want to continue renting by choice or not by choice, they have to become to stay renters because their credit is poor or they don't qualify for a loan. And so even though it would in many cases make sense for them to buy, they're not buying. They're staying as renters, and the home prices are still relatively cheap for the investors who can come in and make those properties cash flow pretty easily in a lot of markets across the country.
You know, in 2008 or 2007, when I talked about how there was going to be this incredible period of time where you could buy investment real estate, I never expected it to go this far down the line. I mean, we're a good 8-9 years past when I was talking about how there was going to be this incredible bubble, and we're at least 5 years past the point where I thought it would completely end. And yet, because of super low interest rates, the relatively stagnant nature of the economy, both here and abroad, there have been conditions for buying that have just stayed incredibly good for investors. I know that home prices are still rising. There, in your report, you found that 56 counties showed home prices rose at least 7% over a year ago, where wages only rose 3%. An additional factor that makes the buying of the home more attractive than renting. What else did your study show?
Well, yeah, I mean, in general, it is better. We found that out of the 461 counties we surveyed, it's more affordable to buy than to rent in 351 of those. But really, on those 56 you were talking about really are the cream of the crop, where I think renters who want to become buyers should have the best chance and also the best opportunity, because home prices are rising and wages are rising. And I think a lot of the reason that renters are not transitioning and not converting into homeowners is because they're not completely confident in this economic recovery. When they look at their wages, they may not be growing. So those 56 markets are places where there is at least an increase in wages. 3% may not sound like a lot, but the national average is about 1%. So at least in those 56 counties, we're seeing that there should be more confidence on the part of renters to go ahead and buy because wages are going up. So it's a better job market. And then on the flip side, we really looked at this from the perspective of investors. And as you said, this investor market has gone on longer than I expected as well.
Right.
Because those renters are just not becoming homeowners, and we still see a deficit of home ownership compared to the past, and that is continuing to drive rental demand up. Even though home prices are also going up, there's still a lot of markets, but we kind of picked out some of the best markets that maybe have been overlooked by investors, mm-hmm. with the highest return on rental property still. So places like Baltimore, parts of Atlanta still are very good, Wayne County, Michigan, which is Detroit. I mean, the common theme is, as an investor, you maybe need to take a little more risk and go to some of these markets that might not have the Class A property that's the best property in the best neighborhood.
Right.
But there are still good opportunities if you're willing to do that.
Yeah, I think that investors really, there's such a lemming mentality where, oh, well, they were in that neighborhood, I should be in that neighborhood. In reality, it's like anything else, right? By the time you buy the mutual fund that had the best return last year, odds are, by great margin, they're not going to have the same return this year. And the same thing with neighborhoods. You almost have to be willing to kind of say, okay, what's the B-level investment, and how do I maybe work out the numbers so I'm buying maybe a $120,000 property, but I'm able to rent it at $800 to $1,000 a month? That's a deal that I would take any day of the week. That's, you know, that's just bread and butter for so many of these different kinds of properties.
Yeah.
And you have to really look at that cost-benefit analysis. And I think a lot of investors who are newer to the game have in mind, oh, I'm going to have a 10 cap rate or something. And they don't even know what that means. But making money month in and month out is actually a terrific way to invest in real estate. At least I think so.
Yeah, absolutely. I agree. And I think, you know, there's a lot of different strategies. But yeah, if you want to get that best return, a lot of times you got to be willing to go against the flow and look at the data and find areas that are outside of the of where everybody else is going. Yeah. But of course, another strategy is, I would also argue on the other side, every market has good, almost every market, maybe not every market, almost every market has good opportunities to buy rental properties. And if you're more comfortable buying in your area, just research and find the best neighborhoods in your market so you can, you know, a lot of people feel more comfortable staying close to home in terms of their investments. And I think that's also a possibility even within a bigger market.
Oh, I think that's the best thing of all. I mean, think about the strategy being you're not going to go for the A plus neighborhood. You're going to go for the A minus B plus B neighborhoods. We don't want you to be in a place where it's just, you know, it's so far out of what you know that you don't understand the housing market. But, you know, start to look at those little neighborhood kinds of counties or neighborhood kinds of neighboring neighborhoods. Boy, that is just incredibly repetitive. But this idea that it's, you know, if you've got an area that you've marked on a map and you want to just move to the outskirts of that to start considering even more properties. And of course, there's always a foreclosure in those areas. There's always a short sale. There's always something. If you get creative and clever,
yep,
you will be able to invest. Darren, great advice. Thank you so much. Darren Blomquist is a vice president with Realty Track, talking to us this week from Miami. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks, Elise.
A little over a month ago, I filed a report about the impending wave of HELOC resets, that's home equity line of credit, from the housing boom days. These resets mean that many borrowers will see their payments more than double as the 10-year interest-only draw periods wind down and the combined payments on principal and interest kick in. So I've asked Greg McBride, he's Bankrate's chief financial analyst, to come back on the show and share his advice about what borrowers who are facing this very difficult financial move should actually do to cope. Hey, Greg, welcome back to Big Money Real Estate.
Thanks for having me, Elise.
So let's talk about the size of the numbers, the sheer numbers of people that this might happen to.
Well, the OCC estimates that we're looking at about $40 to $50 billion worth of HELOCs resetting each year, not just this year, but each of the next 2 years as well. And this is something that, you know, has the potential, even if it's not systemically disruptive, it certainly has the potential to be disruptive at the household level. People that don't know this is coming or are ill-prepared and get caught flat-footed.
So we've got about 3.3 million homeowners existing HELOCs that right now are that $158 billion. So you're calculating that over, you know, 3 to 4 years, roughly $50 billion a year. The individual, typically these people were taking out $30,000 balances, and the recasting of the payments could end up that they're in a situation where they might double, their payments might double to maybe $170 to $180 a month from maybe where they are now, which is $70 or $80 a month. The other thing I think your survey found is that the vast majority of these are attached to homes that are underwater. So what kind of trouble do you think that we're really in here?
Well, I mean, those are the people that I worry about, at least, the people that are underwater, the people that they've been skating by on the interest-only payments for the last 10 years. They haven't really made a dent in the balance. And, oh, by the way, we really haven't seen much in the way of wage growth, right? So
right,
the ability to handle that higher monthly payment for a lot of people, I think, is going to be constrained. So for the people that have some equity in the home and aren't underwater, they have a couple of options. I mean, the mortgage rates as low as they are right now, a lot of people are looking to refinance the first mortgage anyway. You could wrap the HELOC into that and lock in a fixed rate on all of your home borrowing. You could look to just refinance the HELOC itself. What that basically does is restarts the clock on that draw period and kicks the can down the road. But if you're underwater, then your options are much more limited. I think in that case, you've got to get on the horn, talk to your lender right away, see what they can do about either stretching out that repayment period so the payment increase isn't as dramatic, you know, something to just basically buy you some more time to benefit from the recovery in home prices and the paying down of that balance to get into a positive equity position.
Are we making the assumption that people who are underwater are naturally going to have trouble making these payments? Because in a large swath of Georgia, for example, those houses are underwater, but people have jobs and they are actually getting by. So are we making too much of this connection?
Well, the problem of being underwater in and of itself isn't the problem. I mean, that itself is not a catalyst for default. If that were the case, we'd see new cars parked by the side of the road day in and day out as people realize that, oh, my goodness, that car I bought 2 weeks ago, I'm really underwater on. So being underwater in and of itself isn't the problem. It becomes a problem when you intersect that with something else, either the need to sell the home or a big increase in payments that you can't handle. Then it becomes a problem. So it's not the number of people that are underwater that concerns me. What is a bigger concern to me are the number of people that don't know this is coming and don't have the room in their household budgets to absorb this payment increase. If they're in that situation and they're underwater, that's where it's particularly problematic because their options are limited.
So when we look at the numbers, and I think you probably have kept your eyes on this, what is your sense of how much home prices, which have gone up, have floated up, have helped to calm the situation where there's 3.3 million homeowners who are in the situation where their HELOCs are going to rejigger and go up after the 10-year period. Over these next few years, as home prices continue to go up, how many people are just going to, this is going to be a non-issue for them because the home price is rising, so they're no longer going to be underwater?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's really, I think that's a real benefit. And keep in mind that a lot of these home equity lines of credit that are going to be resetting, a lot of them were concentrated in the so-called sand states, you know, Arizona, California, Nevada, and even Florida, that were the biggest movers during the housing boom, where people had the most equity to play with. Well, a lot of those markets have also seen the biggest rebound in home prices. So that's going to be a real benefit. The problem is, regardless of where you live, is the fact that if your budget's not in a position to handle this payment increase, that's going to be the problem. So I don't see this as a systemic risk, but at the household level, it could be a problem if you're not prepared for this and if you can't handle that payment increase.
What do you suspect, or have you seen any numbers about how much foreclosures or short sales or other kinds of delinquency numbers may pop when these all start to hit this year?
You know, I haven't seen specific estimates on that. I think you will see a little bit of an increase, but not enough where it's going to be. I certainly don't see a wave of defaults. You will see, I think, a slight increase, but we're talking about pretty modest numbers spread over a period of several years. So I don't think we're looking at something that's a risk to the economy, and maybe not even much of a headwind to the overall housing market itself. But that's little consolation to the homeowner who is really behind the eight ball on this.
Well, refinancing your mortgage or your HELOC with today's interest rates, you can't beat that. I mean, the rates are still ridiculously low.
Yeah, absolutely. It's a great opportunity. I think for people that have equity, this is a good timing simply because fixed mortgage rates are at 2-year lows right now. So you could refinance that home equity line, wrap it into that first mortgage refinancing that you were looking at doing anyway, and now you've locked in a fixed rate on all that home borrowing.
Which is just great information. Greg McBride is Chief Financial Analyst for Bankrate.com. Hey, Greg, thank you so much, and we hope to have you back soon.
Always a pleasure. Thank you so much, Elise.
So today I'd like to talk about the world of hard money lending, which a lot of people call private lending, and there are some other euphemisms or other names for it as well. And I wanted to talk about the advantages and disadvantages of seeking out this type of loan if you're looking for investment real estate. We've asked Jeff Ball to be on the show today. He is the president and CEO of Vizio Financial Services, which has been rated as the fifth largest hard money lender or private money lender in the United States. Jeff, welcome to Big Money Real Estate. Thanks for joining me.
Hi, Elise, and thank you for having me.
Sure. So there are a lot of other names for hard money lending, and most people are still thinking Tony Soprano, but I'm hoping you're going to tell us that's not really what it's like.
Yeah, no, it couldn't be any further from the truth. The business has come a long way over the years, and actually today there are a number of pretty significant institutional players that are focused on making fast and simple financing available for real estate investors that are really playing a very important role in redeveloping housing across the country.
So let's talk, let's start from the top and talk about why real estate investors turn to private lenders or hard money lenders instead of banks. A lot of this is going to be different from commercial real estate versus, sure, say, buying a house that's going to be rented out. But tell us about some of the people that and the companies that you work with.
Sure, absolutely. So for real estate investors, these are really folks who own their own small business. Their small business just happens to be investing in single family homes. And financing really breaks into two camps. On the first side, you have redevelopment finance, or, you know, commonly called flipping finance. And so this is finance that enables investors to purchase properties, to redevelop them, and then resell them either to an owner-occupier or maybe another investor who is going to rent the property. So that finance tends to be very short-term. Then you also have what is now called landlord finance. This is more permanent finance, although it still remains short-term. 5 years would be long-term finance. And this is finance that's available for folks that are looking to build or expand their existing rental portfolio. And so real estate investors turn to private financiers because they're not able to obtain this type of capital in a fast and simple manner from traditional financial institutions. And that usually has to do with either they already have too much credit on their existing properties, or maybe their credit is not as clean as it could be.
Like with commercial property, maybe a regular lender, a bank, is going to want to see that you've got an 80% leased property when in fact you're just at the beginning and you don't have 80%, but you know you're going to get there in time and want to start building.
That's correct, and I think when we focus in on, you know, single family homes, I think one of the important things to remember is that in this country, the vast majority of the single family rental properties are owned by individuals that own 1 to 4 homes. They do not have the same level of record keeping that you would see with an institution, so right, it's very difficult for them to access bank capital.
All right, so tell us a little bit about the costs involved, because typically private money lenders, hard money lenders, you know, you could be looking at interest rates that are a far cry from, say, 3.5% for a 30-year fix. So what do the deal numbers look like?
Yes, so private finance is more expensive. So when you're looking at short-term capital for improving and reselling a property, you're typically going to be looking at 2 to 4 points, and then somewhere in the 9 to 11% interest range. And that is for a loan that is typically 6 to 12 months.
So 2 to 4 points, 2 to 4 percentage points of the purchase price, and then 9 to 11%. And you want to see your money back within a year.
That's correct.
Okay. And what is the cost do you ever re-up those loans, or then they have to start all over again with the points and the higher interest rate?
Yeah, it really depends. We have one loan product that does offer a renewal feature, and we allow them to actually finance the renewal into the loan if they choose to do so. Different lenders offer different types of products out there,
sure,
but there usually is some sort of renewal feature, and it's also heavily dependent on the borrower needs to have a good payment history.
So tell me a little bit, expand a little bit into that, because I know people who are watching this are always looking for this kind of bridge loan opportunity, which is what you,
right,
would be. If you're fixing up a property, you may need to float that cash so that you use the cash you have on hand to be able to do the fixer-upper, with the idea that once the property is improved and rented, it's going to appraise for much higher. You'll get more traditional financing. But when you go and you look at the investors, what exactly are you using to qualify them?
Yeah, so we focus very heavily on the asset, hence the term hard money. First and foremost, we are focused on the underlying collateral and making sure that we are not advancing too much money against that asset. That's the first thing that we're looking at. And then second, we're looking at a person's credit, their credit score primarily. And then third, we're looking at their investment history. So is this something that they're new to or that they've had a significant amount of experience with? And then finally, we're looking for an exit strategy that makes sense. So if they tell us that they intend to improve it and sell it to an owner-occupier, we're focused on does that market look like it would support an owner-occupier.
So you really have to do a lot of forward-looking to understand sort of what the exit strategy is and how it matches up with sort of actual marketplaces. What do you do when you've got investors who want to do a buy and hold, for example?
Yeah, so on a buy and hold, we're looking at if they don't already own the property, because we do both purchase finance and cash out refinance, if they're purchasing the property to turn it into a rental, we're going to be asking them, what do they think the market rent is? We're very focused also on third-party data sources, what those are telling us as to the available rent for a similar property in that neighborhood. And then we're focused on the condition of the property, because obviously a big part of the operating expenses associated with a rental property, is any deferred maintenance or future maintenance that needs to be reserved against.
How long has Vizio been doing this, and what happened to you guys during the housing crisis over the last 7 or 8 years? How have things changed?
Yeah, so Vizio was actually born out of another business we had started called Econohomes. And so Econohomes during the recession was very, very active in selling single family investment properties to investors across the country. So Vizio was not born until the other side of the recession and has been originating loans now since 2012. And we're closing in on having originated 3,000 loans at this point, and we lend in 34 states.
Which is tremendous. And this puts you, it's sort of interesting, it helps people differentiate when you're talking about maybe hundreds of thousands of loans for some of the big banks, right, and you guys are at 3,000 loans for investors. It sort of gives, and you're the fifth largest. This gives people a little bit of a sense of the size of the marketplace.
Yes.
Just as we're wrapping up, what are your best pieces of advice to investors who are looking at hard money lenders? How do they differentiate a good one from a bad one, from a Tony Soprano?
Right. So I think I would be looking at our mantra internally is fast, simple, and dependable. And for us, simplicity really means transparency around our requirements. You can go to our website, which is Vizio Lending, and you can actually see all of our pricing. And our requirements. So we try to be very transparent because the last thing that an investor wants is to invest time and effort in trying to obtain a loan and only to find out that when they actually get to the point where they may have a deal that the pricing or the terms look very different than what they thought they were.
Bait and switch, nobody likes that.
Yeah, so just I would say transparency. I'd also be looking for, will they tell you who their leadership team is? If not, that would raise some questions in my mind.
I work with the Better Business Bureau. I always recommend that people go to Google search engine and type in the name of the company and the word complaints. Anything else that you'd probably want to verify that the company is actually doing business and has met all of its legislative or regulatory requirements, such as they are, just in terms of if you're a corporation, that all of your corporate papers are up to date. There are no complaints or suspensions against them. Anything else that you think that people should do to verify?
I would be digging into where does their actual money come from? Are they fully funded such that they're going to fund your loan, or are they going to need to gather funding prior to funding your loan? Because it's quite common for private lenders to have a pool of small private investors who fund their loans, but it creates funding risk for investors.
It's a terrific point. Jeff Ball is the president and CEO of Vizio Financial Services. Jeff, thank you so much. Very helpful.
Thank you for having me. Have a great day.
We'll certainly have you back again. So RealtyTrack just came out with its U.S. foreclosure market reports for the first quarter and for March of this year. They do these things quarterly and monthly. The data was mixed, and the first quarter showed the lowest level of foreclosures nationally since the first quarter of 2007 when this whole fun circus began. That marked a year-over-year decrease of 8% and a 7% decline from the fourth quarter of 2014. The numbers for March moved in the opposite direction, and that's not such great news. While there were just over 313,000 foreclosure filings for the quarter, which is great, March alone saw more than 122,000 filings, and that's a 20% increase from February. February had seen the lowest foreclosure numbers in 8 years. March's total is a 4% increase from the same time over last year, 2014. And that marked the first year-over-year increase in September of 2010. So that's a lot of numbers to throw your way, but the bottom line is we're moving in the wrong direction. What's causing this? According to RealtyTrack, the increase was driven primarily by a 17-month high in bank repossessions, right? So banks are taking back properties. And while any increases in foreclosure numbers can seem scary after what we've been through the last 8 years, our friend Darren Bloomquist at RealtyTrack believes that this is just an indication of some stubborn foreclosure cases that are finally getting flushed through the system. And the first-time foreclosure numbers support that perspective, as they were down 8% from the previous year and 11% from the last quarter of 2014. Now, as always, there are some locations where the numbers run counter to the national trend. First quarter foreclosures were up some 58% in Massachusetts, 11% in Virginia and Michigan, and 8% in Illinois. First quarter bank repossessions increased 54% year over year in Ohio, 39% in Maryland, 34% in Missouri, 18% in New Jersey, 16% in Illinois. Who had the most foreclosures? Well, Florida, same as always, Illinois, Maryland, Nevada, and New Jersey are the states with the highest first quarter foreclosure rates. Of those, I would say to you that Maryland is one that is a little bit new to the game, and New Jersey as well. But Florida, Illinois, and Nevada, we've been seeing those for the last 8 years. Now, for metro areas with a population above 200,000, the highest foreclosure rates were found in Atlantic City, New Jersey, Rockford, Illinois, Ocala, Florida, Lakeland, Winter Haven, Florida, and Miami, Florida. So big Florida contingency. It took an average of 620 days to complete the foreclosure process for properties in the first quarter of 2015. That was up from 604 days the previous quarter and 572 days the prior year. It is down, however, from 1,000 days plus, believe it or not, that it was taking in some of the judicial foreclosure states at the height of the recession. The states where it took the longest to complete foreclosures, ending in the first quarter, were New Jersey, where it took an average of 1,115 days, Florida, where it took an average of 975 days, Hawaii, where foreclosures took an average of 1,058 days, Kansas City, where it took 963 days on average, and finally New York, where foreclosure took an average time to complete of 1,475 days. Whew. That's over 4 years, including the leap year. I hope you've enjoyed today's episode of The Elise Glink Show, and I want to send out a big thank you to all of our guests. If there was anything you missed, don't worry. You can find the show notes to this episode at thinklink.com. That's thinklink.com. You can also watch these episodes, some of them anyway, up on our YouTube channel, Expert Real Estate Tips. So youtube.com/expertrealestatetips. If you're new to the show on the YouTube channel, please subscribe. Follow us at Expert Real Estate Tips. And if you're a regular listener and you haven't done so, please consider giving the show a ratings or a review on iTunes. And you can do so by searching for The Elise Glink Show in the podcast section of iTunes. And this helps our show get discovered by lots of new people. I also want to give you a heads up that I am starting a new podcast called Monday Morning Marketing with Elise Glink and John Byrne. John is a longtime friend of mine. He's an amazing marketing genius. He's the former CMO, Chief Marketing Officer, for a huge international law firm. He now runs Glenco Media Group. And he and I are going to get together once a week or so, and we're going to talk marketing. And I'll be giving you some new details and information on that show, which we've taped two episodes so far. We're getting them up in the next week or two through our newsletter. So if you're not signed up for my newsletter, please do that. This brings me to an end of another episode of The Elise Glink Show. I'm your host, Elise Glink, and I'll be back next week with a new episode. Thanks for listening, and have a great week, everybody.